Oder wie geht?
Right. Well, when I sold this bear, I had £500,000 on the book when we did it. And so one was selling them, they were 185, something like that, and we were selling them at 220, 225, I think it was. And so one had put roughly £200,000 profit in one's pocket to start with. So that underwrote it. And we kept the price down, and we didn't call them up. And it took us about 4 or 5 months to get the stock back. But I think, I don't know how much we made out of it ultimately, but as I say, you couldn't do that these days, because that would have to be published straight away, so nobody would do it. But
you described yourself earlier as a, probably unkindly, as a failed accountant. Did you feel that you'd made the right decision about going into the stock exchange and becoming a jobber rather than a broker?
Good God, yes. I don't think I'd even wanted to be a broker. I think I said that I hated being asked what I thought of a share. And I didn't like telling people to buy or sell shares, and I still don't. And when one used to meet people outside the stock exchange, and they were your chums, and they all automatically thought that one bought a share today at £1 and was selling it at £2. So they say, what do I buy? What do I buy? And if it was somebody who didn't know much about the stock exchange, you had to come up with some sort of idea, otherwise they thought you were a complete idiot. But I loathe being asked that question. I always felt a tremendous responsibility if I did sort of say anything. And of course, if it went wrong, and that used to worry me, and I avoided the question like the plague. But on the other hand, I thoroughly enjoyed it being a jobber. I mean, you were effectively your own master. Okay, you had a boss there who told you were a bloody idiot if you weren't one, and that was quite often. But on the whole, you knew if you were doing the thing reasonably correctly, getting on with it, there was job satisfaction there. And I loved it.
Let me ask you a few more specific questions about aspects of the jobbing system, particularly as they came more into prominence in the 1970s. For example, I believe put-throughs became a source of dispute often between jobbers and brokers.
Uh-huh.
Now, you smile when I say that. Could you could you first explain what a put-through was, and then perhaps describe the kind of problems that would come up, and again, if you could recall one or two occasions?
A put-through, if I were to go back to the example of British Sugar and Beresford, if you like, the broker, if I remember rightly, was Greenwell, and he would know, or he had bought stock. I didn't know, but he knew that he had bought stock on behalf of Beresford, and he wanted to buy more. Well, and supposing he had an institutional seller who came along, or just a body, if you like, a corpse, and he knew there was a buyer, well, he would come to us, the jobbers. He'd already, he'd got both a seller and a buyer, and he would want to put the stock through the market. The advantage of that was that it was then known to be the correct price, because the jobber could say, no, it's not the correct price. But what used to happen was, the only rule a jobber knew, to my way of thinking, was rule 90. A jobber knew what was right and wrong, and he knew rule 90. Because rule 90 said that before putting stock through the market, or before, if you have a seller, finding the buyer, you must go to the jobber, one jobber, and say, I've got a seller, and I think I can make a buyer, and what is the correct level to do it? He would actually ask what the price was in, say, 100,000, and you'd make him 99.23 or 99.101, and he would think he would have a buyer at £1, or he could make a buyer at £1, and depending on the size, and you would agree it with him, and he would then go away, and then he'd come back and do that deal. Well, what used to happen was that supposing not that particular broker, supposing he had a nice line of British Sugar to sell, and he didn't know there was a buyer at £1. He would come along and say, I've got £250,000 of these to sell. He'd think the jobber got a half his commission, basically, on the turn, on the deal. And he'd say, I want to put them through at 95 to 95.5. And you'd say, oh, no, you don't. I will give you 99 for that stock. And that used to cause a certain amount of anguish, because the broker thought you were doing him out of two commissions, which effectively were. But then he was not, his function was to do the best he could for his initiating client, which was the seller. And if he's putting it through at 95, well, he's not getting the best when he can get 99 in the market. Mm. And eventually brokers realised this, that they were breaking this rule. But for an awful long time, the rule had existed there, and brokers tended to ignore it. And that did cause problems. Mm. And I suppose when they became more sophisticated, they didn't originally worry. They sold it into the market and got on with the next job. And then they suddenly realised, well, if they found the buyer, that's another commission. So they were stupid if they didn't do it, but they had to do it correctly.
Well, we've been joined by Mr. Don Bailey, who was also with Durlacher. Could you first tell me, Mr. Bailey, how it was that you became involved in the stock exchange?
Well, I joined a firm of stockbrokers called Kemp G in 1959, having come out of industry at that time. My reasons... And the way I joined KMG are quite bizarre. In fact, I went for an interview when I wasn't supposed to have done, but made a suitable impression and got into KMG that way. I was there for 2 years, and I was thinking of packing in the stock exchange as a career, because I was quite disillusioned with working at that time in the city for the broker. And believe it or not, in those days, and Robert would tell you going back, there was something in the firm of Durlacher, Old and Morton Godson, as it was then. And I'd made up my mind that I would only continue in the stock exchange if I got a job at Durlacher, Old and Morton Godson. I mean, you think what happens today.
They were in the same building as you, weren't they?
That's right, they were in Comptall Avenue.
Yeah.
And I went to Tom Sherville, dear man, then, and said, I'd like to come and work for Durlacher, and... I had an interview, and that's how I got there, pure cheap, really. Mm. And that was in 1961. And I spent a lot of time here in the early days of Durlacher, going around the office, learning the office routine, and then spent most of my life in what we call the Bull and Bear department, which was the back office, back up between the systems in the office and the actual trading on the floor. And I had a wry smile when Robert was mentioning some things, because we used to produce the profit and loss for the market makers every day, and I must say, in Robert's case, it was never right. We never gave him enough money. we've always filtered it away into a back book or something. And of course, that way, I came to know both the back office and the trading side. Mm. Spent time on the trading floor, not as a trader, but as a blue button. In the original old stock exchange. But then, as I say, I went back into the office and spent most of my life in the Bull and Bear department, or settlement side, up until being taken over virtually. At the time of being taken over, I was in the training department, personnel department, and I'm now in BZW in the marketing department. I'm a director in the marketing department. That's how I came to be taken over, and I'm responsible for talking to people about BZW now, and certainly the situation in the city prior to the Big Bang.
What was your attitude as a person who was based in the back office to the dealing staff?
Well, my relationship with the dealing staff was very good, but I must say, when they chose me, you were chosen to do the job that I did together with other people, Alan Kemp and people like that, because you were a certain type of person. In the firm prior to Big Bang, of course, the side of the business that was important was then perceived to be the side of the business that actually made the money. Mm. And if you worked in the back office, I think it's true to say there was a certain degree of thought within the organisation that you were just an expense. Mm. An unnecessary expense in a lot of cases, but towards the end of the time coming out to Big Bang, that had changed quite considerably, where people suddenly started to realise there was a value in what was done in the back office. Mm. A lot of people in the back office were quite unhappy with the fact they were never given the chance to trade on the floor, which was the glamour side of the business, the side that made the money. And by and large, they received their due in consideration of the fact that they were taking the risks. I mean, it's not a job. They talked about it being the glamour side. It wasn't a job that would have suited everybody by any means. It was a long day, even before Big Bang, where we start trading now at BZW at 6:30. Well, I'm not suggesting we got in at that time of awake, but it's certainly people were there at 7:30 in the morning. Right. People think the stock exchange opened at 9:30 and closed at 3:30, and that was your day. I suppose you're on the 3:45 train home on the golf course, but of course the truth of it is nothing like that at all.
It's a very fair question, that, isn't it? Because there was no doubt about it, there was a certain amount of feeling between the office and the glamorous side of it, if you like, being on the floor, because that's what you read about in the papers if there's a takeover or there's heavy turnover. But it was absolutely essential to have a good back office, which was well run. Because, I mean, for instance, I can remember an occasion when Nigel Morton went round to the senior partner of Schwader and said, look, we're not going to deal with you anymore because you are not settling your accounts with us. And it was a threat, and he meant it. And they wrang their hands, and we actually sent a couple of people around to try and sort out the account. But some firms did get themselves into an absolute muddle in the back office. And as far as I can remember, I don't think there was ever a question of that. I mean, at times they were very busy. I mean, if you were doing enormous, I mean, I don't know, were 1915.
Well, we were going back to those days, weren't we? We were doing something like 15,000
exactly.
bargains.
Exactly, it's a lot of bargains to be processed.
And we were working Saturdays and Sundays.
Yes, exactly.
And Sir Esmond, at that time, Sir Esmond Delacour was very, very concerned, and so was Nigel Warden. So Nigel Warden was very concerned about the effect it was having on the back office. But certainly your question was, yes, there was a certain amount of glamour attached to the trading side, and there wasn't bad feeling, but we always used to feel that we didn't get the rewards until the very end, when things changed considerably, I have to say. About the back office, when we got the rewards towards it, but you needed to be. You see, the problem with it was, if you're talking about an organisation that was privately owned, with very, very forceful people. Now you had to have, certainly in my case, and we go on and talk about Vic Blake and Lou Monday and people like that. You had to have people who were quite capable when they selected people for these certain areas. Certainly, areas I was in, you had to have somebody who could say, "Please go away. You're talking rubbish." And be able to talk to people, if I can say it, and say, I'm sorry, that is right, because you could be quite easily, you could be overpowered by the personalities of these people. And if you were at all, sensitive, let's put it that way, then you simply would not make it. It was not the place for people of a sensitive nature. I think that's true to say.
Absolutely.
And that was, of course, towards the end, that was amply recognised and accepted by the fact that you had the Beatles, but I can talk about some horrendous characters, not Robert, but some horrendous characters there who would try and literally use their power or their position to persuade you to do things that you really shouldn't have been doing.
Mm. Could you give a few examples?
Yes,
you don't
certainly.
Necessarily have to go into sort of names
well,
and
certainly,
so on.
I mean, there was it's not any secret, but I mean, the fact was that the senior partners of the organisation at that time were very, very conscious about the positions that we ran. And in other words, we were either a bull or a bear. We actually buy shares and hold on to them, or we can sell shares that we haven't got. Now, each of the partners in charge of a particular pitch was given a position over which he could go a bull, and it may be, say, £750,000 worth of stock you could hold on your book over which you mustn't go over that limit. And of course, every morning my particular job was to go into the senior partner and say, look, we're a bull of so much stock on the food pitch, a bull of so much on. And of course, if that particular partner in charge of the pitch has a reason to go a bigger bull than he should have done, because he thought perhaps they were going to go better, but he wasn't allowed to, it was not inconceivable that the partner would come over to the chap on the bull and say, look, take £100,000 off of my book and put it on the back book. In other words, what you were doing, you were taking it off the book and hiding it. And you had to turn around and be very forceful and say, I cannot do that. And of course, it would sometimes say, you can do it because I'm telling you to do it. And I'm very sorry, I cannot do that. And after a while, of course, you get the respect of people for doing that. But at times, if you were new to it, that could be. It wasn't unheard of, Robert.
Absolutely, no.
I mean, it wasn't illegal in any sense.
No, you weren't breaking any rules. It was only a firm's rule.
It was the firm's rule. Where, in fact, the senior partner, who, God bless him, probably didn't know what the position of the firm was at any one time, because it was. I wouldn't say they were maverick in the way they did it, but it's the entrepreneurial approach which you hear was absolutely vital. And if you tried to take that entrepreneurial approach away from people, then you simply destroyed them. And one of the things that's happening in the city now is where that has gone to a large extent.
It's what I was saying to you earlier about individuals being some bullish, some bearish, and the personality of it, as you say, you can't express a personality over a television screen.
We had Basil Sharp, who was a bear tack dealer, who was always a bear, would never go a bull, because obviously if you're a bull, you've got to finance that. But being, of course, a bear is an unlimited liability. So with him, we had other problems. Not problems, but yes. Interesting. If I can come back, can I make a remark on what Robert was saying?
Yes.
When you're talking about put-throughs, I think it's important to realise that if you now, as an individual, want to buy or sell shares, you don't have to go through the stock exchange to do that. You know that you can get yourself a transfer form and do it. And what happened was, at the time of put-through business, if you were the senior a director or the finance director of a big institution, a big pension fund or a big insurance company, and you had a line of shares to sell, maybe a huge amount of shares, say 2 or 3 million, and you knew somebody the other way that wanted to buy them, there was absolutely no reason why you should go through the stock exchange and give a commission. And in fact, there was a thing set up, Robert, if you remember at the time, called Ariel.
That's right.
Which was to, and it, we perceived that as being a great threat to the stock exchange, because they said, why on earth should we go through the stock exchange and give them a turn, put through the business, no risk to the market makers or the broker, and give them this commission? Why should we do that? But of course, as Robert was saying, the thing broke down right at the very beginning was because they could never ever agree on a price, and they had to come into the market to get the price that they could deal. But then, of course, it broke down again because you got 3 million or 50 million or whatever to sell. The person the other way only had 40 million, and I can remember now Robert was saying, well, we didn't see the business. And what they do, they come into the stock exchange to do the residue of the business. And it quickly, and they had a fresh injection of capital very quickly into it, and it just couldn't.
Fortunately, it didn't get off the ground. The other thing, I suppose, as well, was that as far as the inland revenue were concerned, and if it was capital gains, if you had a contract note from the stock exchange from a member firm, that the revenue wouldn't argue with that, because they knew that it had been exposed to that job by way of the put through. So that was one of the reasons we were entitled to our sort of half of their one commission on it, and so that gave it an air of respectability. So, but unfortunately, I suppose one of the contributory facts of the ultimate demise of the system was the fixed commission, because as inflation took the prices of shares higher, the brokers didn't. They stuck by fixed commissions, and particularly in the gilt market, they had the opportunity to reduce them, and they didn't. And I think that caused a certain amount of this unhappiness, because for doing very little, when they knew perfectly well who the buyer was, what didn't take much sort of research or anything like that, they picked up very substantial sums of commission. And I think that was destructive, unfortunately.
Besides put-throughs, minimum spreads is another thing that has been referred to when people talk about the stock exchange during the 1970s. And in fact, your last senior partner told me that you'd rather go off and be a pig farmer if you weren't allowed to have a minimum spread agreement with other jobbers.
Well, I was very much involved in that, and we certainly had them in the food market where I was, because we felt that as long as they were a responsible spread, in other words, we used to. It depended on the marketability of the stock, for a start. But I think it was about 1977, we set up an inquiry, Deloitte. The various half dozen firms sent off figures of leading stocks, such as, I remember, Fison, ICI, Metalbox, and independently, because we reckoned we were losing money in these stocks. And we discovered, yes, that quite a few of us were all losing money. Now, if you're losing money in the stock, I mean, there are most likely two or three reasons. One of them is there are possibly too many jobbers. There just wasn't room. There wasn't enough turnover to go round. Another possibility was that you were making too close a price. In other words, you weren't making enough out of it for a stock when it moved. It's easy if you make your penny halfpenny in the pound, but you don't always do that. And if you're just loss-making continually, well, I mean, what's the point of it? You're better off not dealing in it. And one of the ways you could counter this was by having a slightly wider price. And particularly, I mean, we would do this without an agreement. I mean, if initially there was, after, say, results, and you really, I mean, at times you hadn't a clue what to make. It was a complete guess. Now, supposing a share had been 99 to 101 prior to the results, and the results are far worse than anybody was expecting. Well, it wouldn't automatically make 90 to 3. You might make 85, 90, a wider price. And then you'd buy them at 85, and you'd make 80 to 5. You're guessing. You're shooting in the dark. And so that was one of the mechanisms of self-defense, was the width of your spread. Well, we felt that, particularly in that food market where they certainly did exist, that it wasn't the width of price that mattered to the broker. He wanted to be able to deal, and so did his client. And if you made a very close price, again, the part of our mechanism was, I mean, you'd make a comparatively close price in, say, 100,000 shares, and then he wanted a price in a quarter of a million or half a million, and you would say, right, well, they're 99 to 101 in 100,000, and then 98 to 102 in quarter of a million, if not half a million, or maybe 97 to 103 in half a million. And we felt that what they wanted was that 100,000 is quite a reasonable number of shares in any case. Rather than say they're 99.5 to 100.5 in 20,000 or 25,000 or 10, he would rather know that he can deal all right without even referring. He knows he can deal in 100,000. So we felt that there was an advantage to the client and indeed the broker, and of course there was to us, because otherwise we wouldn't have done it. But that was what lay behind it, and we have very few complaints about it. Occasionally somebody would say, oh, well, you know, the challenges sort of, and we'd say, no, I'm totally sorry, I'm not going to. I've got a living to make, and that's it. And if it was a question of put through, well, then they would do it inside in any case. But that was the justification, and I defend that to my dying day.
I think, who was the senior part that you...
Was it John Robertson?
John Robertson.
Well, I mean, it's quite a fact that we had a survey done by McClintock's business consultants. And at the end of the, I think Dick Wilkins was actually senior partner, it was Dick Wilkins. And at the end of the survey that McClintock's did on Wendelak and Mordant, the results of the survey said that what we should have done as a firm is to stop trading and use the capital, just put the capital on deposit at a bank, and we would make more money without any risk. And I think Dick Wilkins at the time actually stood up at the firm's annual dinner and said it was something like 0.0001 of 1% return on the capital invested. It just any other business would not have taken the risk for the investment because it was so risky. And we would do better than to take our money out and just put it on deposit and all sit back and have no worry about it. And that was the findings of Thomas McClintock.
It was McKinsey's, wasn't it?
McKinsey's, McClintock,
or accountants, aren't they? Yeah.
Something like
that,
yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what they came down and said, you're absolutely mad to do what you do.
Mm-hmm.
The risk is far too great for the return you can expect.
I think we were in the Guinness Book of Records. It was the gilt turner, but to be honest, I mean,
£1.5 billion in one day.
Yeah.
Turnover.
But that was gilt, which is not really comparable with the equities. So.
Now, at the time of Big Bang, or certainly at the time when you sold your sold the firm out to Barclays, you were still a private partnership.
Were we a partnership or a company? We used to change every other week. But,
I remember. I think it was.
I think we were a partnership.
But we used to change a lot. Yeah.
I suppose the distinction I was trying to draw was that a firm like Smith's or Aykroyd's had become listed.
They're quoted.
And this was a route that Wed hadn't chosen.
No.
Was it something that had ever been contemplated?
Do you mean going public?
Going public.
Yes, it had. But one felt that, I mean, I think Aykroyd went public in about 1972, if I remember rightly. Mm. And I think Smith was most likely a bit later. Yes, of course we contemplated it. But I think taking every aspect of it, we felt that it was better to remain, you know, with control ourselves. Yes, I think that was the reason. And I would also add that at the time when it was becoming possible that the jobbing system was coming to an end, in other words, we were talking about dual capacity, which is what you now have, we were one of the last firms. Aykroyd, I remember, said, well, look, this is inevitable. And they had lined up their future partners long before we tried to hold out to try and preserve the system as it was, as we felt that there was merit in it and we didn't particularly want dual capacity. But once they had gone that way, and Smith were saying the same thing, well, there was no point in our burying our heads in the sand, so we had to get on and do something about it. But our initial reaction was to try and preserve the status quo. Now, the pressure came because the brokers felt with negotiated commissions, their income was going to be severely at risk. And therefore, they wanted part of our so-called term. And therefore, they wanted to merge with us. That was their, I think it was called the link argument, wasn't it, or something. It was, and they had their way. And I suppose, on balance, if you think that supposing you wanted to transfer some stock to Don, what actually happened was, and even you knew he was the buyer, as I mentioned, well, there were three bites taken out of that particular, or three charges, if you like, made for taking that piece of stock. You would instruct your broker. He would charge a commission. He would come to me. I would hopefully take something out of it. I'd pass the stock on to his broker, who would also charge a commission. And of course, I suppose there were four, because the government was going to take a stamp, but anyhow. But you could say that it was an expensive way of doing it, because now, let's face it, I mean, there's only going to be one turn effectively taken out of it. And I suppose that was the reason. But if the brokers hadn't been so greedy in the old days and had reduced their commissions earlier, maybe the pressure wouldn't have been there. Mm. But anyhow, that's water under the bridge.
What was your feeling in Wed Dulacca when the Office of Fair Trading took up the stock exchange rule book? Did you regard that as an alarming development? Did you fear that it would lead to big changes?
Yes, very much so. I mean, we resented it. And I actually was supposed to be one of the witnesses involved in it. And I had a ghostwriter, fortunately. Because I could hardly put two words together on paper. And as I said, I'd been a broker if I enjoyed doing that in any case. And it was John Aarons, you know, up in the ivory tower.
Yeah.
And he was my ghostwriter. And I got to know him quite well, and so he would write sort of 10 pages at a time of what I was supposed to sort of say in defence of the system. And then I'd go along and say, yes, well, that's all right, John, but that's absolute balls. And I'd rewrite it for him, if you like. But no one thought, hell, this is, you know, they're supposed to be a Conservative government, they're supposed to be on our side, they're not supposed to be tearing us apart. So one did resent it, there's no doubt about it. Mm. But
well, it was originated by the Wilsonian government, which shows how...
Yes, I suppose
it
was.
Back, yes,
but we thought they would rescind the thing, didn't we? But they didn't.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, you're talking to Graham Ferguson, he will be able to fill in the noughts and crosses.
Yeah.
More on that. But yes, certainly at the time we felt. But if you look at what's happening now, what happened to us years ago is now they're going to have a go at them. They're going to have a go at the, certainly going to have a go at the estate agents now. They're going to, they've had a go at the Law Society, and they've had a go at the insurance companies. It's one of those things. It all seems that I always used to think that we were the ones that were picked out. And now, of course, every time you read or watch a television program, I was watching a television program yesterday, I just saw in the evening, I don't know if you saw about the insider trading side, where they're bringing it all up again. But the going back to what Robert was saying, what happened years ago, and I think probably Ferguson will tell you, Graham Ferguson will tell you when he comes here, what we saw and perceived to be a threat to us was the fact of this thing called arbitrage, where I can go back even to the early 60s where brokers were taking lines of shares on their book to hold until Hiram J. Glockenheimer in New York could be contacted. And then we've got this line of stock, do you want it or don't you? So in fact, what we saw as the jobbing system was the fact that they were actually becoming jobbers because they were holding positions. And of course, there was a lot of bad feeling, if you remember at that time, if you're going to do that, we'll jolly well go out and get ourselves clients because you're acting as market makers.
That's
and I think Ferguson will tell you, right from the very beginning, he perceived that the reason that the gradual deregulation of the stock exchange goes right back to those early days of arbitrage trading, which is now taking on a new concept, as you know, in worldwide terms. But it was that fact that the brokers were taking positions, holding them.
Strictly against the rules.
Yeah.
And of course, I mean, to a minor extent, there were people who were, well, they were, we used to call them shunters. But when you had a floor in Glasgow and in Bristol, Birmingham, these shunters used to, supposing the stock was 19 and 9, 20 shillings. And supposing they were 19 and 4.5, 7.5 in Birmingham, well, the shunter would buy it in Birmingham 7.5 and send it on to us at 9, and that was their function. But of course, I mean, it was only a reflection of the inefficiency of the markets around. And then, of course, eventually we once we had telephones in the stock exchange, we thought, well, this is absolute rubbish. So we got on to them direct. They used to try.